please, you take me to Ali ibn Abi Talib. You make that connection. Whatever barrier there is, whatever sin there is, whatever wrong I've done that has caused a barrier, a disconnect from Ali ibn Abi Talib, or does not allow me, it's a barrier that doesn't allow me to get to him. Ya Allah, you remove that. This will be our conversation. We ask Fatima to Zahra salamullahi alayha for being that coach for us. Ya Fatima, you understand my condition. You see my conditions. You know what I understand. You know what I misunderstand. God has made you such. God has established this for you. And I am begging Him to help me with your coaching and your training and your involvement in my ascension towards Him, as there is no other path other than the Ahlul Bayt. Salamullah alayhim ajma'in.
Ya Zahra, Ya Zahra, flower of Ali. Ya Hawra, Ya Hawra, delight of Nabi.
Ya Zahra, Ya Zahra, flower of Ali. Ya Hawra, Ya Hawra, delight of Nabi.
Ummul A'imma, Bintul Khadija.
Ummul A'imma, Bintul Khadija.
Ruhul Kamal.
Ya Zahra, Ya Zahra, power of Ali. Ya Hawra, Ya Hawra, delight of Nabi. Ya Zahra, Ya Zahra, power of Ali. Ya Hawra, Ya Hawra, delight of Nabi. Ummul A'imma, Bintul Khadija.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Brothers and sisters, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Lantern. How many times in life have you had an opportunity knock on your door, and then forever the reason you took too long to answer that door And that opportunity went away because it probably thought no one was home. How many times has that happened in your life? I know it's happened in my life often because I took too long to respond to that opportunity, whether it was because of anxiety, whether it was because I was too distracted with other things. Those things could have been important, those things could have been unimportant, whatever. But the point is, an opportunity was presented, a door was opened, and then I neglected it, and whooshed, it went away. Do you guys like fish, by the way? It might sound at first that it's gotten nothing to do with opportunities, but once you listen to the story we have in store, you'll change your mind. We'll be right back.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear friends, we have a nice story for this part. Thank you very much for listening to Lantern, Two Fishermen. One day the two fishermen were fishing in a nearby pond. Both of them were looking forward to have a fresh fish afterwards. They both have packed utensils, cooking accessories, ingredients, and fishing equipment. Once they arrived at the pond, they chose to sit at a distance to hunt for fishes. The first fisherman caught a big and beautiful fish within a few minutes. He was very happy. He then placed the fish in the icebox to retain its freshness. He would cook it whole fish in the noon. He caught a few more other small fishes after a while. He froze a few fishes to take it back home. After about an hour of fishing, the first fisherman offered to help the second fisherman. The second fisherman politely declined, and the second fisherman also caught a large fish. Surprisingly, he threw it back into the pond. The first man was bewildered by his act. He remained silent as he watched the second man capture many big fishes only to have them thrown back into the water. The first fisherman, annoyed by this act, retorted, "Why are you throwing the fishes back into the water? They were beautiful and big." The second fisherman replied, "I know they were big, but I don't have a big pan to cook the big fishes, so I'm looking for a smaller fish that fits my cooking pan." The first fisherman was startled by the response. He advised the second fisherman to cut the big fish into pieces to fit them into the small pan. Yeah, many of us are just like the second fisherman. We tend to overlook a handful of opportunities, chances, and even fortune that come in our way because we are too stubbornly looking for what we want. We need to learn to capture every opportunity and work it out so that it will fit into our lives perfectly. Most do not understand the wonderful opportunities life gives until they are looking back. The sentence was from Eric Handler.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
That is the case with the opportunities in life as well. If we lose sight of them and we tell ourselves that, yeah, it's always going to be there, before we know it, we'll raise our head and we'll see that that floof of cloud we had been watching 2 minutes ago is gone. So it's really important for us not to lose objective, not to lose perspective, and to constantly stay focused on what we want to achieve so that when opportunities that can further serve that objective present themselves in our life, we don't lose sight of them and we don't miss out. Another narration from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam reads quite a similar narration actually, and it tells us that whomsoever a door of opportunity opens for, they must value it because they don't know when this door is going to close. We really don't. Or in another narration, His Eminence says that missing out on opportunities in life is one of the causes for sadness and grief. So God knows, maybe a lot of us who are miserable, I know I am sometimes, is because we don't have that sense of fulfillment in life. It's because we feel that we haven't lived up to our fullest potential. We haven't achieved anything. And that in reality, we've lost all those good opportunities that were presented to us that could have made us a better person and could have ended in better results in our life. The solution? Well, I personally am still trying to figure it out, but I could say one of that is to stay vigil, to keep an open mind and keep an open heart to the opportunities that present themselves in our lives. And that is only possible if we set a goal for ourselves. If we have a certain set of principles, if we discipline and train ourselves and determine a path, a course that we want to take in our life and the goal that we want to reach, then and only then will we be able to recognize the opportunities that come along and have the encouragement, have the inspiration, have the morale, and have the courage to seize those opportunities and make the best of them. If we don't have an objective in life, and if we don't have discipline, we won't feel any inclination toward opportunities because we'd feel, so what? Well, what am I going to do with this now? We don't have a cause that we'd wish to serve through the means of this opportunity. So I think that's the most important thing we can do for ourselves. And it's the most important thing we can do to find meaning and fulfillment in our lives. Not to feel useless, not to feel like a piece of trash, not to feel like our life sums up to nothing, and we are nothing, and we've achieved nothing. It's important to set goals and to be disciplined enough to attain them. There are tens and tens of narrations that talk about this matter, and many, many, many verses in the Quran that discuss this. And it's quite logical that those instructions should exist, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says himself in the Quran that we have not created heaven and earth and this world and all these complex, beautiful, various creations for nothing. They're all created to serve a common divine objective. They're all moving toward a common direction. And for us to think otherwise is just undermining our own existence. It's not going to hurt or harm God in any way if I think that He did not create me, or that I didn't have a purpose, I just happened. But it's going to drain and rob me and my life of all sense of meaning and life, really. Don't lose hope. Everything is going to be okay. Tomorrow's a new day. You got this. Just seize the moment. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
Ala bi dhikrillah tatma'innul qulub.
Communicate.
Israel is conducting a targeted campaign against Palestinian prisoners and the organizations defending them. There are currently around 4,600 Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. These figures are from 2020 because Israel refuses to release the real numbers anymore. Around 500 of these Palestinian prisoners are being held in what is called administrative detention. This means they're imprisoned without charge or trial, and they're not even allowed to know why they are in prison because it's secret. At the same time, there are many people fighting for these prisoners' human rights and for their freedom. Palestinian lawyers, human rights activists, NGOs, civil society groups. Israel has attacked these groups for speaking out against its crimes. We know from recent reports that several activists at Palestinian NGOs were spied on after discovering that their mobile phones had been hacked. Their devices were infected with Pegasus, an Israeli cyber weapon. It allows the attacker to turn on the targeted person's microphone, camera, GPS tracking, and view all their messages, photos, and contacts. This spyware, made and sold by an Israeli company, has been used to target journalists, human rights activists, and dissidents all across the world. Israel's actions are not only an affront on the human rights and dignity of Palestinians, which it imprisons without charge or trial, but also an affront on those who defend these prisoners and fight on their behalf. Israel calls itself the only democracy in the Middle East. That's a joke. It couldn't be further from the truth. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The Israeli occupation in Palestine has many tools that it uses daily to oppress Palestinians. One of the most archaic is something called administrative detention. Administrative detention means you go to prison without even being charged with a crime, and there's no trial. The Israelis use this regularly to throw Palestinians in prison, and even if someone is placed in administrative detention, they're not allowed to know why they're in prison. The Israelis keep a secret file, which neither the prisoner nor their lawyer is ever allowed to see. Administrative detention typically lasts 6 months at a time, but can be renewed over and over indefinitely. Every 6 months, the Israelis can just decide to extend the order and keep someone in custody forever if they want. This can typically go on for years. Israel's administrative detention is a violation of the Geneva Convention, because administrative detention by an occupying power is supposed to be used only in extreme cases and on an individual basis. It is not a substitute for a criminal justice system or due process. The Geneva Convention stipulates that in order for administrative detention to be permissible, the person being arrested must pose a significant threat which warrants such detention. Once that threat is gone, the person must be released immediately. Israel doesn't do that. It imprisons people indefinitely and doesn't even tell them why. The way Israel uses administrative detention is not on a case-by-case basis, but as a form of collective punishment. In 2021 alone, the Israelis issued more than 1,500 orders for administrative detention, according to the NGO Ad-Damir. Since 1967, Israel has issued 50,000 administrative orders. This is a clear violation of Article 33 of the Geneva Convention, which prohibits collective punishment. Article 71 of the Geneva Convention says that, quote, "No sentence shall be pronounced by the competent courts of the occupying power except after a regular trial." Israel violates this by only placing Palestinians before a military tribunal. There is no regular trial. Article 66 of the Geneva Convention says that prisoners must be sent to a non-political military court located inside the occupied territory. But Israel, again, violates this by sending prisoners to courts located outside the occupied territories. And then another breach. The prisoners are sent to prisons outside the occupied territories, which is in violation of Article 76 under the Geneva Convention. Now, the interesting thing about administrative detention is that it was actually created by the British when Palestine was still a British mandate. In 1945, the Defense Emergency Regulations were enacted, which allowed the British, who occupied Palestine at the time, to establish military courts where civilians could be tried without right of appeal. Sound familiar? British forces could impose curfews, search homes, seize items, any items, and even destroy houses too. The British also gave themselves permission to censor publications and the media. Well, guess what? Israel kept a lot of these so-called laws, which were created by the British and imposed on Palestinians. So basically, Palestinians went from living under British colonial rule to living under Zionist colonial rule, with many of the same archaic laws still in place, and a few others amended or repealed. And of course, one of the laws that the Israelis kept from the British was not just the media censor and all the other things, but also the administrative detention, used mainly against Palestinian Arabs, no different than in 1945. Now, joining me to talk more about Palestinian prisoners and administrative detention is Milena Ansari. Milena is an international advocacy officer at Ad-Damir Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association, which is a Palestinian non-governmental organization that advocates for Palestinian political prisoners. Milena, thanks for joining us. I'd like to start out with a report that Ad-Damir released in October. You said that there are around 520 Palestinians who are held in administrative detention without charge, without trial. Could you maybe tell us exactly how administrative detention works and how it's used as a form of collective punishment against Palestinians?
As of the 6th of December, there are 500 Palestinian prisoners under administrative detention without trial or charge, including four Palestinian children under the age of 17. The Israeli occupation relies on administrative detention, which is a procedure taken from the British mandate defense regulations back in 1945. So the basis of this administrative detention goes back to the British mandate that is still being implemented on the Palestinians. What this administrative detention entails, that the Israeli occupation forces can literally arrest any Palestinian without any charges and without continuing a fair trial for them. And all of this is based on secret material that is most of the time made up by the Israeli Shabak, which is the Israeli security or the intelligence services. What's even more arbitrary regarding this policy is that it does not have a strict limitation or a duration. The Israeli occupation can indefinitely hold Palestinians under administrative detention and indefinitely renew their detention without trial or charges. This has created a loophole under the legal system where the Israeli occupation just calls, this person is a threat to the security of Israel, we should detain them for an indefinite time. And we're talking about four Palestinian children under administrative detention that Israel says they impose a risk to the security of the region. What the risk is, nobody knows. Neither the detainee nor the lawyer are allowed to access these secret information, which creates also a psychological torture and ill treatment for the detainees because they are unaware of the charges that are brought against them and they are unaware of the duration of the time they will be spending in Israeli prisons under extremely harsh conditions that do not meet the adequate living standards of a basic human life.
There are six Palestinian prisoners who gained a lot of attention recently because of their hunger strike while in administrative detention. They went on hunger strike for many, many months to protest their captivity under administrative detention. Kayed Fesfouz went on hunger strike for 131 days. That's half a year. And his case drew a lot of attention and support from around the world. He ended his hunger strike on November 22nd, 2021, when the Israeli occupation agreed not to renew his administrative detention. He was released on December 14th, 2021. Miqdad Al-Qawasmi ended his hunger strike on November 11th. His hunger strike went on for 113 days. He's set to be released in February 2022. Shadi Abu Akar began his hunger strike on August 25th, 2021. He's been detained by the Israeli occupation, again, without charge or trial, since October 2020. Now, he went on his hunger strike for 69 days, and he suspended it on November 1st, 2021, after the Israeli Prison Service, the IPS, decided to terminate his detention in April 2022. So that's when he'll be released, according to the Prisoners Affairs Committee. Melina, can you tell us a little bit briefly about how these prisoners began their hunger strike and why it's so important? And what is Ad-Damir's role in all this? What are you doing to help these prisoners, to support them and everyone who's on hunger strike protesting their administrative detention?
It's important to bear in mind that Palestinian prisoners initiate an ongoing hunger strike as part of the resistance of the Israeli occupation's arbitrary policies. The cases of the six Palestinian prisoners under hunger strike in the past 2 months has highlighted Israel's systematic reliance on administrative detention to detain Palestinian and maintain control over them.
Now, although these men have achieved a somewhat favorable outcome, you know, they're finally out or soon to be released, it's really important to note the toll that such a prolonged hunger strike takes on someone's health. You know, this was a near-death experience for many of these prisoners, and that's the point to which the Israelis drove them. There was a constant fear that these men would die at any moment. They lost so much weight that they would drop in and out of consciousness, their organs were about to fail, you know, they could barely speak or drink water.
The Israeli prison services and the Israeli occupation in specific, they do not care about their health conditions or what implications of the hunger strike has on their bodies and health and threat to life. They only aim to keep Palestinians in detention. When we're talking about hunger striking detainees reaching 100 and plus days, this is not something to take lightly at all. But we've seen the Israeli military system continuing on approving the renewal of administrative detention and freezing the administrative detention order. They will continue to freeze the order, and then when they see the health condition of the prisoner slightly improving, they will re-establish the administrative detention order. So for them, it's a game that the Israeli system, the judicial system, gives legal cover to and allows. The freezing order, it explicitly means that the prisoner is now the responsibility of the hospital and not the Israeli prison services. And this entails additional ill treatment of the prisoners and detainees.
It's really important to note, however, the game being played here by the Israelis. When we talk about certain prisoners being released, Israel didn't just decide to release them from custody immediately out of compassion or something. You know, Israel still insists that they serve out the entire duration of the detention and only to release them afterwards. So although these men are now free or soon to be free, the Israelis could at any moment rearrest them and throw them back into prison for no reason and keep them there indefinitely. That is the cruelty of administrative detention.
It's important to note that when the military courts freeze the administrative detention, it is in no way does it mean that the detainee is now free or the detainee is not under detention anymore. It only means that the Israeli prison services is not responsible for his life, whatever happens. And the cases of the six Palestinian detainees this time showed us clearly that the Israeli occupation does not care.
There are many Palestinian NGOs and civil society groups who fight on behalf of Palestinian prisoners. On October 25th, 2021, Benny Gantz, the defense minister of the Israeli occupation forces, issued a military order declaring six of these Palestinian civil society groups as terrorist organizations. These six organizations are Ad-Damir, Al-Haq, the Bison Center for Research and Development, Defense for Children International in Palestine, Union of Agricultural Work Committees, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees. The United Nations called Israel's terrorism designation a, quote, unjustified attack on Palestinian civil society. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, issued a statement on October 26th saying that the concerned organizations were some of the most reputable in Palestine and had worked closely with the UN for years. Bachelet said that, quote, claiming rights before a UN or another international body is not an act of terrorism. Advocating for the rights of women in the occupied Palestinian territory is not terrorism. And providing legal aid to detained Palestinians is not terrorism. Now, one of the NGOs outlawed as a terrorist organization by the Israelis is El Damir, where our guest Milena works at. Milena, can you tell us what your reaction is to all this when Israel designates six Palestinian human rights groups, including El Damir, as terrorist organizations? You know, what is the basis for this kind of accusation? Why do you think the Israelis are doing this?
As a clear answer to your question, I would say there is absolutely no basis for this designation and outlawing six prominent civil society organizations that work in different aspects of the Palestinian life. We have from the six organizations, these organizations work with children, political prisoners, women, farmers and peasants, international reports on the violations of the Israeli occupation, as well as research and documentation. So in a sense, there is absolutely no basis for this. This is part of the Israeli occupation, systematic targeting of civil society organizations to silence them and isolate them from the international community, because they are at the forefront of the organizations that are opposing the systematic and arbitrary policies by the occupation. And we are working to change the paradigm advocate for the rights of Palestinians on different sectors. And most importantly, we are calling the international community to stand against Israel as an apartheid regime and settler colonialism. So in a way, it is mainly to silence our organization, isolate us from the international arena, and discredit our organizations. Many United Nations organizations and international organizations have condemned this action and called that it is not only attack against the Palestinian community, but the whole international community, which is 100% true, because we do legitimate human rights work that Israel is afraid that the international community will see.
And what are some of the other ways that, you've been harassed or intimidated by the occupation forces in your day-to-day operations?
The designation of our organization and further outlawing them in the West Bank is not a single act. It has been, our organization has, organizations have been under attack for several years in this Israeli campaign to silence us. This includes residency revocation. For example, one of Damir's employees, Salah Hamouri, is now the Israeli Interior Minister. Approved a decision to revoke his Jerusalem permanent residency because he lives in Jerusalem under the allegation of breach of allegiance to the state of Israel. So in addition to the harassments we face, Israel as an occupying power is expecting us as human rights defenders and lawyers to serve loyalty to this occupying power. Other than residency revocation, there are arbitrary arrests without any basis. And this is what we see that happened with the Palestinian health work committees, where it was also outlawed by Israeli military orders. And following the outlaw, several staff members were arbitrarily arrested. For example, the director, which is a 60-year-old Palestinian woman and human rights defender, Shada Oudeh. Other than arbitrary arrest, there has been also travel bans on the employees. There has been intimidation and harassment, threats even of murder to the employees and staff. This is all important to understand that these policies are, their only aim or goal is to intimidate the defenders of human rights and to make sure that they are in a way to deter any voicing of opposition against the apartheid regime.
Speaking of harassment, here's another interesting revelation. At the same time Israel declared these six Palestinian groups terrorist organizations, it turns out that Israeli spyware was used to hack the mobile phones of the activists and employees at these very same Palestinian NGOs. An investigation by frontline defenders revealed that six employees of the targeted Palestinian groups had had their mobile phones hacked. This included at least one person working for Al-Haq, another for Bison Center, and one for Al-Damir. Amnesty International and Citizen Lab, who've done extensive work in exposing Pegasus spyware, corroborated these findings. They discovered traces of Pegasus, which is a piece of spyware, a cyber weapon, developed by an Israeli company called NSO Group. Pegasus allows the attacker to do whatever they want with the victim's phone. They can turn on the microphone, the camera, the GPS, and view all their messages, photos, contacts. Frontline defenders suspect that the timing of this terrorism designation, after discovery that the phones had been hacked, is not a coincidence. Technically, NSO Group, the company that makes and sells Pegasus, claims that it only sells Pegasus to government agencies who are trying to solve serious crimes or deal with counterterrorism. So by declaring these NGOs as terrorists, is the Israeli occupation government trying to somehow justify using Pegasus? Nevertheless, one thing is crystal clear. Israel is doing everything it can, from spying to outlawing these NGOs and Palestinian civil society groups, in order to stop them from exposing Israel's human rights abuses and crimes against Palestinians.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
To give you a better understanding of how cruel administrative detention is, many people have had their detention renewed on the way out of prison. So they would be at the prison gate, ready to leave, ready to go home, thinking that they're free and they can see their family, and then the Israelis tell them that they have to go back into prison again for 6 months. Some people have even been stopped outside the prison, already on the way home. They get pulled over at a checkpoint and told that their administrative detention has been renewed and they must go back to prison. Administrative detention is obviously not just a barbaric and cruel form of punishment, but the toll that it takes on the prisoners and their families, emotionally, psychologically, is tremendous. Someone might be arrested by the Israeli occupation forces and then jailed, and then their parents, their siblings, their partner have all been to prison. It seems that almost every family has had someone imprisoned by the Israeli occupation. Israel calls itself the only democracy in the Middle East. Israel isn't a democracy at all. How can you be a democracy when you randomly throw people in prison without telling them why they're in prison, and then you refuse to charge them or try them? What kind of a legal process is that? That's not even a kangaroo court. It's just barbaric. How is that any different from what the United States does to people in Guantanamo Bay, where it imprisons men for years without ever charging them or convicting them of a crime? These are the kinds of practices that the Americans and Israelis accuse other countries of doing. They accuse the Arabs, the Iranians, the Russians of doing this, but they themselves are complicit in this behavior. The Israelis and Americans act like they're civilized and democratic and they're better than everyone else, as if everyone else comes from the jungle and just doesn't get it. But look at their behavior. Look at what Israel and the United States do, and you will find a lot of hypocrisy and a lot of authoritarianism. Administrative detention is a cruel, barbaric practice. It doesn't just hurt the prisoner, it hurts their family as well. There's no such thing as Israeli justice. There is no justice for Palestinians. There is only a brutal military occupation that exists to protect a racist settler colony that steals land from Palestinians and kills them or imprisons them when they try to resist. Administrative detention is a leftover colonial practice from the British Empire. How fitting that the Israelis kept it to use it against Palestinians. It's just further proof that Israel is a British creation. Palestinians essentially went from living under British colonial rule to living under Zionist colonial rule, with many of the same archaic laws still in place. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Questions and answers. In Islamic upbringing,
I have a son. He's really in front of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, issues, and other relevant questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers provided in this program are mostly based upon the holy book of the Quran and upon the narrations of the Prophet, and naturally of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all. Joining us in the studio is our dear friend and Islamic researcher, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Today, dear Sayyid, we will again be talking about the subject of how we can raise our children without employing any violent manners, and we do so because it is a very important subject and is a very important lesson for the dear parents to understand that hitting your children is not permissible in any way, shape, or form in Islam. Last, we spoke about some preventative measures we can employ to avoid having situations where we may be agitated enough to lash out on our children. One of these ways was saying that it is very important that we engage the mind of the child. We should not leave any free time for the child to do whatever they want out of boredom, because then bad things will happen, unfortunately. So take them to the club, teach them something, teach them a skill, or whatever it may be, just to employ their mind. And if the children are nagging, following a punishment, for example, it is very important that the parents should show them that their efforts are futile by ignoring the child, because by then the child will understand that nagging is not going to lead to anything. Dear Sayyid, what else must we keep in mind?
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjal farajah. So just to refresh the memory of the listeners, that we said in Islam, it is absolutely forbidden to harm a child physically in any way, shape, or form.
Or any other human being for that
matter. Or any other human being in that matter. Yeah. Or even emotionally, it's also forbidden. But at least physically, we know that you have to pay gold.
Right.
So we try to find preventive measures and ways where we can try to apply in our lives and with our kids to make sure that we don't resort to violence and hitting children.
Right.
So we mentioned a few. So inshallah, let's mention a few more inshallah. As well.
Is anger management one of them for the parents? Anger management classes?
It is.
Well, very good.
we will come to that in a minute.
Right.
So we did say that before that we have to encourage positive certain ethics and behaviors in the child.
Right, yeah.
We did say that we have to create something for them to do, give them a purpose. And we have to work on the fact that we need to give them support when it comes to their self-building as well. So as a child, he wants to do things and achieve things.
Right.
You give him the support to do what he wants, to have that ability in himself, and you take his self-esteem to a higher level.
Hold that thought, dear Sayyid. We'll be continuing after a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing ways to raise our children without using violence. Dear Sayyid, just before going on a break, you were saying that...
So I was saying that when it comes to kids, we need to give them the support that they require in order for them to have, motivation and self-confidence in themselves. Right. One of the ways that we could encourage our kids to have self-confidence in themselves is the fact that we choose activities or get them to do things that
they are good at.
We know that they are either good at or they can do.
Right.
Right. So what happens is they end up doing it, they end up achieving it, and as a result, me and you, we give them the encouragement, we give them the all the nice words, all the applause that they require, and therefore they feel a lot better about themselves.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. So even though we created the scenario ourselves, now the child, he feels more in touch, he feels more stronger, he feels more empowered, he feels a lot of good things.
Yeah.
And this is what we want to do. We want to create a lot of good things, if you remember we spoke about that.
Yeah.
So it overtakes the bad things, but obviously, I mean, don't overdo the
of course.
The compliments.
Yeah.
It has to be within limits, because otherwise it could lead to...
self-conceitment.
Spoiling, and it's like self-conceit or... all the things that we're trying to avoid in the first place.
Yeah.
So that's also another thing. Amongst the other preventive measures that we can use is we need to teach the child to learn to control his anger and be calm himself whenever he gets angry, which obviously would lead me and you to be going and angry ourselves and... obviously, being balanced with a child.
Yeah.
So we need to learn to teach the children to relax and calm down when they're angry. For example, if the child gets angry, hold him, touch his hand, for example, set him down, tell him it's okay, let's find out what's wrong. So that itself
should also then help them.
The situation.
Should also only teach them how to calm down. We should also actively help to make them calm, right?
Yeah, exactly. So either way works.
Right.
So when you do teach them how to become calm and relax and control their anger, obviously that would save you a lot of problems as well when they get angry. So you don't have to, go and punch them in the face and... what have you, or breaking around things.
Whatever your solution was beforehand.
Yeah, so just that itself, just telling the kids that you're, to learn to control themselves also will do a lot of wonders, which a lot of people don't do.
Right.
I mean, even we have a hadith from the Prophet, it says if someone gets angry, touch them.
Yeah.
There's like, I don't know, subhanAllah.
Touch their hands.
Especially with relatives. If you touch them while they're angry, they kind of cool down. So this is also... another preventive measure that we can try to apply in our life to avoid violence.
And with that, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how to employ different manners of raising, teaching, and educating our children that are not violent. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us further.
Another preventive measure with children is showing them emotion. Okay, the child himself, he needs love and care, and so what happens to him when he gets in a situation or situations where he feels danger, he feels worry, he feels nervousness,
right?
So obviously, and the hormones in his body go high, and you know, he starts to react to the hormones in his body. So you know, he would need a lot of affection, a lot of love, to accommodate for all these feelings,
right?
Okay, and the more you come to him, the more you try to help him out, the easier he will feel, then the better you will feel. Because you know, sometimes a lot of people find it very hard dealing with kids, for example, who have fear phobia, for example, of darkness or dark rooms or closed doors or what have you. And sometimes the parents get really frustrated with this.
Yeah.
So sometimes if the child is going through a certain fear, a certain emotional problem, usually that drives his hormones to a high level. I mean, so you need to find a way to show them love, show them support, show them compassion.
This is a basic human skill, they say it, to show anyone. As
of course.
Some people show they show this skill to their animals when they're scared of thunder, whatever it is. They go and comfort them and whatever. So we apply the same, but even more so because it's a human child. Comfort them.
Of course. It's just a human need.
Right.
And like I said, in doing so, that should save you a lot of problem. Should save you a lot of anger.
In the long run.
And it should save you, hopefully, from hitting a child, because the more safer the child feels around you, the more he will cooperate with you, the more he will do what you want him to do.
Right.
As simple as that. So we can also put that in our bucket list when it comes to trying to avoid violence our kids.
Right.
Also, we need to create, along this note, a sense of respect between the son and the child. And obviously from a young age as well. You create that bond between the father and the mother and the child themselves when it comes to dealing with one another.
Right.
The way we talk, the way we, you know, communicate, the way we look at each other, the way we interact in the house. So all these things, if the child is get taught from a young age about them and learns to respect his father in the house, that always saves the father from many issues and many problems.
Right.
He knows that he should not raise his voice over his dad. He knows to be quiet when his dad is talking, for example. He knows that this particular, for example, method, you know, his dad hates.
Right.
And so on and so forth. Knowing these things, and the father also knows what makes his child not happy.
Right.
Right? Or things that his child might hate. And then you have this mutual respect between the two.
Right.
So my dad respects my privacy, and in return, I respect my dad.
Right,
you know what I mean? If my dad disrespects my privacy, I'm not going to respect him in something else.
A symbiotic relationship.
Yeah, so you would have this respect between the two of you that should also help to act as a preventer from having to resort to violence.
And with that in mind, dear listeners, we will have to end today's program because we are out of time. I thank you for your insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any comments or questions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. In addition to that, we also have social media accounts on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Fi amanillah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is
this
for
is,
a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
Sheikh Javed Akbari, the researcher on Islamic studies from Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Just as the human body becomes sick, so does the human mind. The sickness or the illness of one of them has an impact on the well-being of the other. If the mind is sick, the heart will also be sick, and the body will also be sick. And if the body is sick, the human mind will also suffer. You know, both of these two elements of the human existence are susceptible to outside influences. To put it differently, in the same manner that the body system becomes disturbed by various illnesses, the harmony of the thoughts becomes disturbed by different factors and evil traits. Man has the faculty of mind which cannot be independent of a person's conduct. The human conduct and behavior has an impact.